There is still a feeling that the quality of writing from today's students is not what it should be. The issue may not be with the students.
I thought I must make students do a research paper, and over and over and over again, the results would disappoint.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear again why improving the quality of writing may start with the death of the five-paragraph essay. We'll also spend an academic minute looking for education potential in your genes. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Professors and colleges and universities across the country don't agree on too much, but most will tell you that they think the quality of writing from today's students is somewhat lacking. John Warner thinks he knows why. Warner taught college-level writing for over 20 years and says the problem isn't caused by a lack of rigor or smartphones or some weird generational character defect. He says we're teaching writing wrong. He makes his case in the rather well-written book called Why They Can't Write, Killing the Five-Paragraph Essay and Other Necessities. John Warner is a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, a contributing blogger for Inside Higher Education magazine, and the author or co-author of 7 books. I spoke with him last spring about this project.
Well, a lot of it is rooted in my firsthand experience teaching college-level writing for 17 years, all told. And one of the things I was noticing in my students was not a diminishment of their skills or abilities, but their attitudes towards writing. They really felt defeated by writing. They saw writing as something you only did for school, or the writing you did for school was something that was different than the writing you might do in the world. And the purpose of the writing was to demonstrate a kind of performance of intelligence, or that you had read what you were supposed to read. And it didn't have any of the qualities of writing that I associate with it in my work as a writer, which is to wrestle with ideas and express what you have to say to the world and engage with others who have ideas of their own and build your ideas from theirs. And so I wanted to find out what was going on. Why is this happening? It got me to start digging into what was happening to the college students I was working with before they showed up in my classroom to cause their attitudes to erode, to look at school, writing in school, as something that was something akin to pure drudgery or worse in some cases.
You put just in the subtitle of the book, Killing the Five-Paragraph Essay. Why does the five-paragraph essay deserve to die?
So this has been a source of some controversy since its use is so ubiquitous in school. I should say the five-paragraph essay is more avatar than cause. It is a symbol of what I think is going on. But it is a form that you very rarely see out in the world. We don't go around pointing at things we read in a magazine or a book and say, there's a five-paragraph essay. It's a form that's imposed from the outside as a way to help students create things that resemble the traits we expect in good writing. That is, they have a central point and they're well organized and they are well evidenced. But as I went looking at the use of this five-paragraph essay, I could see that it was really in the service of a larger system of assessment where we want students to prove a kind of quote-unquote proficiency. And the way we're going to do this is to train them to write this very narrow, very prescriptive form of the five-paragraph essay, and that will substitute for actually knowing how to write and express ideas. once we start privileging the form and the assessment, we beget some, what I think are some counterproductive approaches to teaching. That is, students are told things like, make sure to have your thesis at the end of the first paragraph, even though many of the academic writing we'll read, and certainly the writing of the world, the thesis is not at the end of the first paragraph or is even not stated at all. It's implied. They're told things like no fewer than three and no more than five sentences per paragraph. I've had students that are told no fewer than seven and no more than 11 words per sentence. Prescriptions like never use I when you are writing, no contractions, all kinds of things. When you conclude, always start your final paragraph with in conclusion, even though we'll never read something in the world that starts with in conclusion, or if we did, we would roll our eyes at what the author is trying to do. So these sorts of prescriptions become the point, as opposed to the wrestling with writing, which is what I think writing is, which is trying to corral an idea into a form that makes sense to serve the needs of the audience. We have these shortcuts that don't allow students the meaningful journey. And so the five-paragraph essay as a tool, as a kind of symbol of this assessment regime, of this push towards a kind of proficiency that I argue is at the surface as opposed to being meaningful, that was my way of sort of targeting that overall scheme. Just saying never write a five-paragraph essay again by itself probably doesn't do much, but it is a handy frame for people who are engaged in this sort of activity. Everybody knows the five-paragraph essay.
You seem to have the same sort of way of approaching the research paper, too.
Yeah, it's, you know, for years and years and years, because I had absorbed what, you know, the culture I had been educated in, I thought I must make students do a research paper, and over and over and over again, the results would disappoint, even if everything had been going well early in the semester. And what I came to realize was truly how difficult the task I was giving students. If we just pause for a moment and think about the task of a research paper, to say, create an original argument about a subject of which, in the student's case, they have very little to no knowledge at the start, while integrating 5 or 8 or 10 or 12 secondary sources as part of your argument in the span of 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 weeks, if we're pushing it, in a 15-week semester. Very few accomplished professional academics or writers could do that. If you asked me to start from scratch a research project on a subject I knew nothing about and said you have a month of, let's say, I'll be generous, 8 hours a day or 8 hours a week, since I'm also taking my other classes or doing my other job and this kind of stuff, I would not turn in a particularly accomplished piece of research because my writing proficiency and skill has been honed over years. It would look okay, but it wouldn't be meaningful. And that's what was bothering me about the student work. They were performing research rather than doing research. They were going through motions that said, look, I can use a library database or I can paraphrase a source without even understanding their own sources. And that just began to seem to me like a waste of our collective time, and to sort of cling to the research paper as something you're supposed to do because it's college, it didn't make sense. I wanted them to do the work of research. I wanted them to think like researchers and act like researchers, particularly the critical thinking associated with research, but that doesn't have to take the form of a quote-unquote research paper.
And you said it kind of showed up in their writing, too, at the end, didn't it?
Yeah, their writing would be very cogent and interesting and alive early in the semester, and at the end, all of a sudden, all of that interesting person and thinker and scholar would disappear as they were subsumed by the sources they thought they were supposed to be using. They were entirely deferential to these secondary sources because they really didn't know and had not had enough time to know all that much about what they were writing about, which is simply not the state that academics are in when they write research. We are, to some degree, expert. It doesn't mean we don't discover things when we research. We discover things all the time. But those new discoveries get to combine with the existing body of knowledge. And when we're thinking about students, particularly college freshmen, to impose a kind of academic frame out of the gate where you must research academic things that academics do and you don't get to start from your base of knowledge or your interests is putting them behind the eight ball in a way that, speaking as a writer and college instructor, I would never accept for myself. I would not accept for example, a article commission or a book contract about a subject in which I was not at least somewhat versed. And it was counterproductive. It was defeating for the students emotionally. The progress that we all felt they were making at the end, I would do at the end of every semester, I have a one-on-one conference with each student about their semester and their final portfolio, and our parting emotions were fatigue and sorrow. And that's just not how I wanted them to exit what in some cases was going to be their only writing intensive course or writing specific intensive course in college.
Still to come, our conversation with John Warner continues with a look at what Warner calls academic folklore. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is John Warner, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, contributing blogger for Inside Higher Education magazine, and the author of Why They Can't Write, Killing the Five-Paragraph Essay and Other Necessities. In the book, he talks about teachers falling back on what he calls academic folklore. I asked him what he meant by that.
Sure. Academic folklore is similar to the research paper. It's the things that we as instructors do because it was done to us, like the research paper or the prescriptive isolated teaching of grammar, or as I experienced in junior high, sentence diagramming. I think knock on wood, that has largely fallen out of favor since we know that it's an interesting activity in and of itself, but it does not translate to improving one's skills as a writer. And this folklore becomes very powerful. Grades, the way we grade and give feedback is a form of folklore, and over time I radically changed how I see grades as a aid to learning or a hindrance to learning. And for years I didn't question the folklore. I was not a great student. I was an eager writer and I loved writing. I had grown up reading books all the time. My mother had owned an independent bookstore in the town I grew up in, so I had read forever, and I loved reading, and I liked writing. But I was not particularly good at school, and I thought that was my fault, that I was defective. And for a long time, I brought that attitude towards my own students, that they were like me. They were lazy, or they were disengaged. And over time, it was a matter of sort of forgiving my past self and recognizing that, in fact, a lot of what I was asking them to do was built in this folklore that was not linked to learning. So I started examining everything I was doing in my class and simply asking, does this help students learn? And if it doesn't, then I'm going to try to put something different in its place.
Is that something that one instructor can do in one class, or is that something that has to be done system-wide?
Ooh, boy, that is a penetrating question. And the answer is yes to both, except if it's not going to happen on a broader scale, the impact is limited. I think any instructor can push back against folklore in their classes. This is what I do when I teach. I have a companion book to Why They Can't Write called The Writer's Practice, which is a book of what I call experiences. Others would recognize them as assignments that are my attempt to create an atmosphere freed of the folklore. But if it's going to be isolated, if it's alone, it's often, a fleeting oasis in a desert for students. And students may appreciate it. They may like your course. But a lot of it these issues, if we are truly desiring students to write better, and we can discuss what we mean when we think about those terms, and I'm happy to discuss those things, it does mean examining some of those systemic things. It cannot only happen at the class level. So I vacillate between great hope, because I know what we can do differently, and I am hearing, since the book has been out for a few months, I'm hearing from a lot of people who've read it and are recognizing their experiences and mine in the book and are pushing back. But until, you know, some of the things that impose what I think are these unproductive assessments or unsustainable teaching conditions on instructors themselves, we're only nibbling at the edges.
Nibbling at the edges. That brings us into the food section of the interview here. Why is describing how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich the most important exercise you've ever done?
So this belongs to my third grade teacher, Mrs. Goldman, who I'm pleased to say is still with us. And I sent her a copy of the book with a note of thanks for teaching me this now 41 years ago. If I can believe that that's the case, that I've gotten that old. It's the moment in class she asked us to write instructions for a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and she had brought in the ingredients and implements necessary to make it. And then she made us try to make our sandwiches according to our own literal directions. And as one could imagine, it was a disaster because we left out things like using a knife, spread peanut butter on bread, or the amount of peanut butter or jelly or anything like that. So if we didn't say we used a knife, she said, well, God gave you two hands, I guess you should use those. And what I realized in that exercise, the epiphany I had in third grade, is that writing is for other people. It is to be used. And writing a peanut butter and jelly sandwich is a very simple and straightforward way to understand the rhetorical situation of audience, message, and purpose. And I use that exercise in just about every class I've ever taught. I use it in seminars I do with faculty as I talk about the principles in the book. In fact, I'm doing one this coming Friday where I will do it. And we recognize that thinking about audience first, thinking about what we want to say to them and what they're going to do with what we have to say to them, instantly transforms how we view the task of writing. Very, very little of what students are asked to do in a school context have any audience, any genuine audience or any need, other than a teacher where the purpose is to prove their studentness, for lack of a better word, that they're capable of doing the things that we expect students to do, which are often divorced from the stuff humans do and people do. It's as though we've created this other purpose and this other identity. So I like to use that as a lesson for them. And for me, it's just a reminder of the fundamentals and that it happened 40 years ago and we're still struggling with these things is, you know, a sort of humbling of how complicated and difficult it is to talk about and make these changes that I think are so important and so valuable.
Just as an aside, how excited was your teacher to get that book and that note? That must have been great.
It was fun. You know, she's retired in Florida, and she remembered me and my older brother and all of my classmates. And it really is sort of a testament to, you know, teachers in general. The book is dedicated to my grade school, all of my grade school teachers, because I feel like I learned more about how to write from them than maybe anybody since. And, you know, that's what keeps people coming back to teaching, is the sense that you made a difference in the world. And so every time I do it in a class or a seminar or wrote about it in the book, it's in both of my new books, I have to remember Mrs. Goldman and to be able to send her the books and thank her was it was great for me, and I know she really appreciated it as well.
You do spend a good chunk towards the end of the book about helping teachers teach. That sounds like a very important chapter to you.
Yeah, I you know, it's what I've spent a good portion of my adult life doing, teaching writing. It's a subject of endless fascination for me. I love the sense, teaching writing is a lot like writing in that you, it's an extended exercise in failure. You make your best plan and your best effort and you put it out in the world and it never goes perfectly. So you learn from what you did and then you're going to try again. So that part of the book is really a way of expressing the journey that I went through and changing my own teaching approaches in moving away from the folklore and moving towards what I call the writer's practice, orienting around the skills, attitudes, knowledge, and habits of mind of writers, and really how much that shift helped me as a instructor, not just in that I think it did help students and help them write better and change their attitudes towards writing. It helped me bring my practice in line with my values. The things that I think are important about writing are now reflected in how I teach writing. I like things like the ideas and the voice and the original perspectives of individual writers, and I wanted to begin to value those things in students. Why not? Why deny them access to those things that I think make writing most meaningful for me just because they're students? Writers are writers. And I finally realized that if we can treat students as writers, they will improve as writers. If we treat them as creatures who have not yet earned the right to write, they'll never get there. And that last third to half of the book is really my encouragement for teachers, in a lot of cases, to trust their own instincts about what they think their students need in order to thrive in this dimension.
Can you see that in a class? Can you look at your students and say, okay, I can teach this one to write, but this one over here, he's a writer?
So every student enters at a different spot, but all of them, from the first moment they step in, are writers. And that's one of the things I want them to embrace, is they are not all going to have the same lives as writers when they exit the class. You know, some will major in rhetoric like I did, or they may go on to write professionally or semi-professionally or just for fun. Others may only write when sort of required for work or other things that are going on. But as members of the world, as people who communicate with other human beings, they are going to write. And the fact is that they'll be better communicators, thinkers, writers if they have this sort of practice. And you see it. You see their attitudes towards writing change. So even writers who are not as far along, who are not as confident, will often progress much further than those who were farther along. They may not catch up, but to me that's not important. There's many writers who out in the world who I deeply envy, because I know I will never be as good as they are. I don't have their particular view of the world, or they're harder workers than me. I don't know what it is. But the process is what matters. The journey is what matters. And if I can get that across to students, they will keep improving after they're not in my class. I want to arm them with the skills, attitudes, knowledge, habits of mind of writers that allow them to keep going even when I'm not around.
Again, the name of John Warner's book is Why They Can't Write, Killing the Five-Paragraph Essay and Other Necessities. It's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Maybe the secret to good writing and most other academic skills are in your genes. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Do your genes decide the highest level of education you'll receive? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Daniel J. Benjamin, associate professor of economics, discusses this question.
Studies of twins and adoptees have shown that genetics has some influence on how much education people get. But which genetic variants play a role? Together with several colleagues, I organized a team of hundreds of scientists from across the globe to try to identify genetic variants associated with the number of years of formal schooling a person receives, or as researchers call it, educational attainment. To conduct the study, we analyzed data from 15 countries, obtained from over 70 genetic databases, including the personal genomics company 23andMe. Our data includes more than 1 million people of European ancestry, making it the largest genetic study ever published. We identified nearly 1,300 genetic variants associated with educational attainment and found that, individually, each of these genetic variants predicts only a tiny difference in the length of someone's formal education, at most, just a few weeks. Next, we created a single variable that represents the collective effects of many genetic variants spread across the entire genome. This combined variable could predict educational attainment as well as, or better than, many demographic factors that influence educational attainment, including household income. Keep in mind, no gene or set of genes determines how much formal education a person will complete. Instead, in combination with environmental factors, thousands of genes influence people's cognitive skills and personality traits, which in turn influence how much schooling they choose to get. For this and other reasons, predictors of behavior based on genetics should not be used for personal life choices. However, the genetic predictor we created is a useful tool for research. For example, ongoing work is using it to shed light on how genes interact with environmental factors to influence academic achievement.
That was Daniel J. Benjamin of the University of Southern California, Dornsife. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.